Number shark. 30. 30 seconds. I'm on right now. I don't believe you. What?
You're listening to The Hockey Show on 101.5 UMFM.
All right, we're on.
Ready, Phil.
We're on in 5, 4...
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Good evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Hockey Show here on 101.5 UMFM, Canada's only campus-produced radio show that strictly talks hockey. Glad to have everybody with us tonight as we get into another fun show here. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, things are going well for you?
Yeah.
Right on. That's good to hear. Obviously, a little rainy here tonight in terms of where we are.
A smidge of hail.
Yeah, the smidge of that frozen rain didn't come down so well, but see how everything goes after that. Obviously, big show for us here tonight. We're excited to bring in a guest tonight. We picked this song, actually. We'll meet him in a minute, but you likely recognize Gord Downie's voice on this song, Courage, their third single from their 1992 hip, tragically hip album, Fully Completely. Song actually hit number 10 in Canada on the RPM singles chart. Charted both in the U.S. and in the Netherlands as well.
Nice.
So kind of cool to see that in terms of the Dutch people falling in love with the hip there. It was nominated for Song of the Year in 1994 at the Juno Awards, and perhaps the coolest fact of all, between 95 and 2016, this was the most played song by the Tragically Hip on Canadian radio.
I mean, it's a fantastic song. I can definitely see why.
I mean, yeah, take nothing away from the hip at all. I mean, most of their songs are pretty solid, so nothing wrong with that at all. But again, speaking of courage, that theme's going to come up a few times tonight, as we're going to meet this gentleman right away. In case you weren't aware, though, today, Thursday, May 16th, 2024, is the 13th marking of the Global Accessibility Awareness Day. The purpose of Global Awareness Accessibility Day is to get our Global Accessibility Awareness Day, if I could say that properly. The purpose of Global Awareness Accessibility Day, Accessibility Awareness Day, I'm going to do that all night, I think. Is to get everyone talking, thinking, and learning about digital access and inclusion and people with different disabilities. Now, you might be asking why digital access and inclusion is a big thing, but digital accessibility refers to the ability of people with disabilities and or impairments to independently consume and or interact with digital applications and content. For example, the UMFM website doesn't have it. Apps like Instagram, not known to have it in terms of what's going on. So there are a lot of apps and websites that don't have it. According to research, some 98% have some sort of accessibility failure.
That does not surprise me.
That doesn't surprise me.
Like, it's definitely something that when web design is happening, there is zero consideration for anybody outside of
I totally get it.
Able-bodied person.
I mean, the weird part, though, and this is the part that might surprise you, 1 in 8 people, 1 billion people worldwide have some sort of disability that affects accessibility to various digital means. So that's pretty big. You think that would be a little bit more.
Obviously, we have a 2% strike rate on accessibility.
Yeah, we're not doing so good. In the sport of hockey, though, we've seen a number of advances in making the game a little bit more accessible when it comes to things like sledge hockey, wheelchair accessible rinks, elevators, that kind of stuff. We still have a long way to go. And that's where our guest tonight comes in, because he's done some remarkable things to make hockey entirely more accessible for those that want to play. The Hockey Show, as you know, has always been proud to welcome decorated athletes and individuals to the show, but we often get to chat with these distinguished people after they've stood on podiums, accepted awards, or hosted trophies that represent their accomplishments. Tonight, The Hockey Show is proud to feature a guest who is up for, in this show's opinion, one of the toughest awards to win in the NHL, which he's up for this season, as we'll meet this trailblazer in mere seconds. It seemed like our guest was destined for brighter lights and bigger rinks as he was growing up in Toronto, but losing his vision meant that things changed when it came to those dreams. Yes, those changes to those dreams didn't quite land him in the NHL, but The Hockey Show would argue that founding an organization that became the Canadian Blind Hockey Association, winning multiple gold medals with the Canadian National Blind Hockey Team, and being a finalist for the 2023-2024 Willie O'Ree Award at the NHL level, are still pretty incredible dreams to achieve. For those that don't know, the Willie O'Ree Award is presented annually to an individual who, through the game of hockey, has positively impacted his or her community, culture, or society. If I can spit those words out. So, let's meet this man. Let's get everything going tonight. Who is the NHL set to honor? Tonight, the Hockey Show is proud, honored, privileged, humbled, and pleased to welcome Mr. Mark DeMontis to the program. Mark, can you hear us?
I can hear you. How are you guys?
Hey, how's it going?
Going fantastic. And I'm just so grateful for you to take the time to have me on, and thank you.
Oh, no, we are certainly, you know, like I said, proud, humbled, honored, pleased. I mean, we wanted to learn all about all the stuff you're doing and get into some of the stuff that we don't know about. We've never been exposed to, you know, blind hockey and stuff or whatever. So this is kind of the stuff that we want to get into and certainly learn a little bit more about as well. So thanks for doing this.
Thank you. And, you know, I always say when it comes to accessibility or disability or adaptive forms of hockey, it's so important that, you know, able-bodied allies and, you know, you want to learn and take the time, and so we appreciate that very much.
Again, we're always happy to learn. But for the start of this interview, like we usually do, we're going to cast our eyes kind of back to the beginning. So we're going to jump back 37 years to April 20th, 1987, where the DeMontis household got a little bigger when a baby boy was added. What was life like for you growing up in Toronto?
Life was great. I grew up in a community in Toronto called Weston. It's a very historical town, right in the city, and very, you know, has major hockey history roots. You know, the original CCM factory, for example, was from Weston. The iconic Weston Lions Arena, which is just as much known for its French fries, was also a big practice facility for the Toronto Maple Leafs back in the you know, in the 60s, for example. The famous Johnny Bower Way on Petite Avenue is in Weston, and there's just so much more. Peter the Barber has a famous barber shop to cut the hair, and of a lot of the Leaf players, and it's just so much hockey history. I grew up playing there, and you know, in like any Canadian town, I like to think that Weston has a lot of that history that most people don't realize or know about. Paul Coffey, Adam Oates, Weston Boys, but one I like to always share, Geraldine Heaney, you know, women's hockey player, pioneer.
Legend.
Weston, Ontario there. So you know, I'm so proud of where I'm from, the community, family, friends, and growing up, I grew up with a stick in my hand on rollerblades and screaming car just like anyone else.
Right on. That's awesome. Obviously, you know, we've done a little research, looked into a little bit of things. Apparently, you were pretty good at this little game called hockey, which was great to see. What position did you play, Mark?
You know what? I played everything. I played forward. I played in club hockey, varsity hockey. I played defense. I kind of played whatever coach told me, and I was a role player. You know, I was always whatever coach wanted me to do. I was I bought in, and I. I was small. I was always a smaller player, right? I was a lot shorter than most. I played way taller than my actual size, and I used to like, you know, like anyway, I wasn't too scared to go into a corner against someone twice my size, and I think I always talk about now how I look back in my life playing hockey and how much I was kind of fearless going up against bigger players. I kind of, you know, look at it no different than life now, going up against big challenges and just never really being scared. And I think that helped a lot too when I was faced with my own life-altering condition at 17.
You played in the GTHL. Who did you play for in that league?
I played York Toros. Was a big team to play with, and we grew up playing out of Western Lions Arena, which was so cool. Like, yeah. I was able to play club hockey in my hometown rink, and was able to walk to the rink, which was pretty cool, kind of with a suit and the bag in one hand. And one of my childhood best friends, Ellie Mador, who's now a really prominent opera singer, he lived down the street from me, so we used to walk together to the rink, and we'd have our parents driving behind us. And then I had a quick cup of coffee with the Toronto Young Nationals. That was my mid to triple A year. I was just about to go to junior camp, and that's kind of a goal of playing college hockey in the States. And that was always a goal, is to get an athletic scholarship and go NCAA.
Any famous teammates that came out of the GTHL that you played with?
Oh, that's a good question.
I mean, GTHL, we know the guys that went through there now in terms of, you know, like the McDavids and all that or whatever. But anybody that you remember that kind of went, yeah, you know what, he ended up going somewhere.
Yeah, you know, the big name in our year was Andrew Cogliano. That was a big name. Funny enough, my national team coach on the blind hockey team, Paul Cairns, he went to RPI, but he was a big name too. Him and Cogliano used to battle for points often. And,
nice.
Cog went to the NHL, and I think Paul Cairns was probably one of the guys that I think should have been in the NHL and could have gone. And now he's a phenomenal teacher and doing a lot in the school system. But those two names are big ones that I'd say. And other guys, maybe Ryan O'Meara, Theo Peckham. Eventually, I played a little bit with him, and he ended up a quick cup of coffee too in the NHL. And Matt Pellick, a really good friend of mine. Perry ended up first round in 05 to the Calgary Flames.
Yeah.
And really, really good pal and big supporter. And now I know he's got his brother Adam on the New York Islanders.
That's so right.
Kind of cool watching his little brother play when he was just a kid running around the rink. There's a lot of hockey names, but I'm most proud of just kind of the fact that even if my players and the teammates I grew up with, didn't make it, there's just so many awesome humans and individuals had the chance to play with, and so just proud to be a teammate still and catch up with old friends. And some of my closest friends are guys that I grew up playing with now, and we still spend a lot of time together. And I think that's part of that strong hockey community in Toronto. Players, once they're done the game playing in the G, they end up just having that mutual respect for each other and keeping in touch over the years. So really cool.
That is awesome. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, Mark, you mentioned that you had some interest in playing the NCAA. Was there any interest for you in going like the OHL route or maybe the U Sports program route? And kind of at the end of the day, what drew you to taking the NCAA path?
You know what? The reality was I wasn't good enough to play in the OHL. I kind of really started picking up my game in my midget AAA year.
Okay.
So the Bantam draft, like I was still playing AA. I wasn't strong enough. At that point, when I started playing midget AAA, I was like, you know what? I was hoping to maybe go to junior A tier two in Ontario in the OPJHL. And then kind of thinking that'd be the best route, because really, ultimately, I was always a strong academic student, so yeah. I always kind of wanted to really leverage that. But I was really fortunate too, like for the past many years, my cousin Robbie ended up kind of being able to live my college hockey dream. He was a Yale University grad, a Yale Bulldog.
Oh wow,
my cousin Robbie, and he just wrapped up. Maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago. At Yale, so my brother and I would go down to New Haven, Connecticut, watch the Yale Bulldogs play, and just be so proud that my cousin was living that NCAA dream. So I just love college hockey. I'm a big fan. My brother and I follow a lot of college.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, I love the CHL, but there's just something about the dynamic of college. Again, as mentioned, my national team coach and my best friends, Paul Cairns, played at RPI, so. When I was studying in university, I'd often take trips out to Troy, New York, to watch the RPI engineers.
Nice,
play.
Yeah.
And that was a good time, and that was always great hockey.
So, I mean, obviously, NCAA dreams in terms of coming up there. Were there a couple of schools? You don't have to name names, obviously. I mean, if you don't want to, it's up to you. But did you have your eye maybe on a school or a couple schools where you're like, if I get to play hockey, that's where I'm going?
Yeah, I think I always had an interest, like my cousin Robbie, in the Ivy League.
Yeah.
That was really important. I think a strong academic, life is just as important as an athletic life. And so Ivy League schools would have been cool. But I mean, I was right when I had really started getting going, I would say to people, like, that's when my kind of life took a turn. Like, I felt like right when things were starting to click, and I was starting to put up points, skate, better than I ever have, and starting to find my stride. That's when everything just took an unexpected turn. That I went from playing really competitive hockey to within weeks back down playing house league and select with my childhood friends, which was like really unexpected as a result of dealing with sight loss.
Yeah, we can actually focus on that. So at you mentioned it was happened at 17. I want to discuss it a little bit further. You were diagnosed with Leber hereditary optic neuropathy. So what exactly is that condition, and how does it affect you day-to-day?
So LHON, Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, is it's a rare optic condition that takes away the central sight in someone's eyes. And it happens quite drastically. It's unexpected. So I was playing competitive hockey. I was at training camp at the time. I was just signed with the Toronto Young Nats, and I was having trouble kind of seeing the puck. So what happened was I was starting to lose my central sight. So everywhere I was looking, objects were kind of moving. So players and pucks, they were starting to vanish. I was playing outfield, a member of baseball, getting fly balls, and I would look at the ball, and all of a sudden it would vanish. And I just thought I needed glasses, but what happens is the condition takes away the central sight in your eyes pretty fast. Over about 3 to 6 months, I lost about 95% of my sight.
Oh, my gosh.
It was pretty tragic. I mean, not just for me. It was tragic for my family, my friends. It was just like, because no one expected it. It was not like we all thought, like we knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And it just, I just think it would happen at the worst time. Like, it wasn't like, it was like I was just starting to get going and I think that's one thing about my story. I always talk about and share it because I'm very open about it too. And it's just like when I was when it happened, it wasn't that it happened to me, but it felt like it happened at the pinnacle, the very worst time anything could have happened that could have been negative, because I felt like there's so much positive going on. Like I just signed this contract. I was skating well. I was just nominated student council president of my high school. Ed March was at an all-time high. Like everything was just going. And then this happened, and it was devastating, right?
I mean, just hearing that it happens in 3 to 6 months, that would, like, that's quite honestly, when you said it happened quickly, like, that's ridiculously fast.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm not the only one, right? Like, there's kids that this is happening too. There's people that get faced with a tragic accident. They lose their sight rapidly. I have friends like that. I've lost their sight within seconds, all of it. I have friends who have been faced with other life-altering conditions or faced with disability, all forms of disability, and it's happened rapidly. And every day I try to just find the positives.
Yeah.
The fact that I still have some partial sight, the fact that I lived a lot of my life with the ability to see, so I still remember visually faces of loved ones, family, friends. Some moments that stood out to my life, I still remember them vividly. And I mean, like, I just try to find the positives every day and try to, I try to, even when I'm watching hockey, like, I'm just following by ear, but in my brain, like, I'm watching a game unfold based on broadcasters doing play-by-play in color, that it's because I, had that ability to see very fortunate that.
I mean, obviously, being diagnosed with something like that changes your life. It steers you away from, what you love doing. I mean, hockey was baseball, that kind of stuff. Obviously, a lot of good stuff that way. You're getting, good marks in school. You're moving on to, other and bigger, maybe potentially better things in terms of getting into university, all that kind of stuff. Comes about, with a pile of emotions as well. Anger, hatred, sadness, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I read that you battled depression for a few years following diagnosis. And again, we don't make light of that stuff here. Jason and I both take mental health very seriously on this program. So, again, I know it couldn't have been easy, and it wasn't easy. And certainly we're not here to minimize the effort that you put in and to find your way out. But how do you navigate yourself out of a negative headspace like that? Because, I mean, you're the only one that's, and I don't want to say you're the only one that's quote unquote suffering. I mean, obviously your family and everything, has their own suffering to do, but like you're experiencing it firsthand. How do you get yourself sort of out of that moment where you're like, I hate everybody and everything?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. And because I went to my senior year of high school, I still knew all my friends, and a lot of them didn't see the vision loss still. They kind of still just, for them, it was hard to tell. When it really hit me was after my grade 12 year, went off to university, I went to Western, studied there. When I went there, that's when it really hit me, because I ended up going from being someone that everyone knew, and to going away 2 hours from home from Toronto to London, Ontario, where I knew nobody. Like I was now not just the new kid on campus, but I was a new kid on campus with a disability, with the ability to see unsure where anything was on campus. Like, I wasn't able to read anymore. Like, it was just a drastic change. And you know what? It wasn't easy also because I didn't know anyone else that had an eye condition until, I would say what really changed my life was when I was introduced to a blind hockey team called the Ice Owls. They've been around since 1972. They're the Toronto Blind Hockey Team. And that moment really changed everything because it gave me the chance to actually meet others who were also visually impaired or blind. And that put me, that gave me a second wind, I always said, because I was at a tough point in my life between just kind of lost a bit of hope. I was just really down. I was really hiding it though. Like, I wasn't sharing how tough how I was dealing with it. I put on a front a lot, like, especially on family friends. Like, I was very much hiding it. I didn't want people to see the struggle that I was dealing with. I didn't want them to have to worry. I didn't want them to have to feel concerned about me. But deep down, like, you know, nighttime or when I was on my own, like, a lot of it was, you know, it was tears, and it was me trying to figure out how the heck I was going to get through this. And even if I wanted to get through this, right? But again, having a strong family, parents, my brother Luca, close friends, they pulled me out of bed those days when I didn't want to get out, and they, you know, they reminded me, you know, there's so much more to life than giving up. But I think that the one person I always say that had a really big influence on me, you know, after I lost my sight, really small world, but there's a late Dr. Herb Carnegie, who really ended up taking me under his wing through the Future Aces Foundation. And what I really needed to do was, I was holding a lot of it in, what had happened to me. And until I really started speaking about it, going to schools with Herb Carnegie and his daughter, Bernice Carnegie, who I consider a mentor even to this day, that was when it became really therapeutic for me, because I became so much trapped inside of me, but I wasn't talking. And ever since I started doing that, and then at the time, Herb Carnegie, and for those of you that may not be familiar, which I think everyone should be, and take the time to be educated on his story, really being denied from the National Hockey League due to the color of his skin and the barriers he faced, but using that adversity and that discrimination as a way of shining a positive light on what's possible and changing the lives of so many at-risk youth across the country. And again, if you're not familiar with Herb Carnegie's story, please do. You know, he was inducted as a builder in the Hockey Hall of Fame, and still to this day now has the Carnegie Initiative in his name, and they're doing incredible work in the diversity and inclusion space in the hockey world. But Herb at the time he had glaucoma.
Right.
And he didn't know many others who were blind. I didn't know many others who were blind. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting next to a legend, you know, going to school with him, soaking in stories of him with John Beliveau and soaking in what it took him to have courage. And don't get me wrong, these are two different complete scenarios. And if he was denied from the game due to the color of his skin, which is something I'll never be able to relate to.
Yeah.
But what we shared was vision, and we shared this bondness of blindness, and also we shared the fact that we both dealt with adversity, different, but nonetheless still the same type of feeling that something was taken away from us that was out of our control. And so when I tell people that, you know, I had this relationship with Herb Carnegie, they can't believe it. Like, I mean, I always tell people, I'm so proud of the fact that I knew him, because again, most people only learn about him now. They read books or articles or stories or documentaries, I'm so proud I actually had that relationship with him. And I mean, there was a lot to say. And part of his Future Aces creed, you know, kind of coming up the top of the show with courage and the hip, but the courage is one of the characteristics in his Future Aces creed. And I really took that word seriously from him, and it's something that I still do to this day.
not to, again, not mm-hmm. to jump in with anything. You were a Herb Carnegie Future Aces Scholarship Foundation, or scholarship or foundation scholarship recipient, excuse me, in your time. So that's kind of awesome.
Yep.
But you did mention, you know, just how good he was. I don't think people realize just how good he was. From 1944 to 1948, he was either named the MVP or was the leading scorer in the Quebec Professional Hockey League, which is where all of those guys from the old Canadians got basically mm-hmm. their start. And I mean, when you're talking about a guy who legitimately was one of the, and again, this is where the term comes from, he was on a line with two other black men, and they were called the Black Aces. Yeah. And the reason that they didn't, again, they were, you know, oh, we should call them up, you know, we should get a, you know, in terms of the playoff name now, the Black Aces that sort of go up there. That's where it came from. These mm-hmm. guys were always good enough to play in the NHL, and they never got called up. So I think that the stories from Herb Carnegie are fantastic, and I wish people, like you said, knew a little bit more about it. So definitely look up some of that stuff. I think that's fantastic, so...
Yeah, it's so important we educate ourselves on Black history, and it's so important we educate ourselves on individuals who have changed the face of the game, and what we can do as a culture, as a hockey world, is educate ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's so important to me, you know, whether it's Herb Carnegie, whether it's Willie O'Ree, you know, we take the time to educate ourselves on people. That's it. We have to really learn what people have dealt with and recognize, you know, what people have gone through. If not, we're ignorant to the realities of barriers people face. And like, you know, Herb Carnegie is the best player who never played in the NHL, and it was because of the color of his skin. And I just think that he was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame, and but I think that more and more people will find out about him. I also recommend reading his book, A Fly in a Pail of Milk.
Oh, nice.
It's a great book, and it gives you, just by the title of it, I'm sure it gives you an example of some of the barriers he faced.
Yeah.
At the time as son of two Jamaican immigrants growing up in Toronto, and what he had to deal with to find his place in the hockey game.
And you mentioned them a little bit earlier, but I want to go back and talk about the Toronto Ice Owls blind hockey team. Can you give us just a little bit of a background on who they are,
yeah.
how long you know, play with them, and just kind of what that team and discovering that team meant for you?
So this team has been around since 1972, and it was very much played underground. This is a team that very few knew about. And when I was growing up playing at Western Lions Arena in Toronto, minor hockey, there was a time when we used to have like charitable events and fundraisers. And so when I was a kid, I think I was about like 9 years old, and the Ice Owls came to our arena to put on a charity event. And at the time, I was obviously sighted. But I remember sitting there in the stands just being like mind blown that people who were blind played hockey with, you know, a large adaptive puck. At the time, it was actually a hollow barbecue wheel with piano keys inside of it. and I was mind blown. So when I lost my sight, right when I got released when I was 17 from the Toronto Young Nats, I remember getting a phone call. I took the call at the time. I didn't have cell phones, so I took the call at the time. This was in 2004, so I maybe had a flip phone and didn't even know how to use properly. But I took a call upstairs in, you know, kind of the bedroom of my parents' house. I remember receiving the call, hearing the words from the coach saying, you know, kind of, we're going to let you go. You're going through a lot right now, sort of thing. And then walking down the stairs to my dad, who was just sitting there on the couch, and he could tell I was, you know, distraught about it, and it was tough. But then I just was sitting there, and it was quiet, and I just remember he looked at me, and he was just like, what about that team, that Ice Owls team? You know, that I remember when you were a kid, Mark, and we went to watch them play. You know, why don't you give them a call? And like, I don't know, the one thing with me was I think one of my proudest things I always share with people is that I did make that call.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. because a lot of people don't. Like, they could have gone, they go years without wanting to give it a shot. But I remember actually making a call, calling Ed Parenteau, who unfortunately we lost a number of years ago. I remember calling Fast Eddie and saying, hey, I'm 17, recently diagnosed. I play AAA. I would love to try out for the team. And I remember he chuckled on the other line and saying, you just made it. This team, again, like, there's a few of them. There was the Toronto Ice Owls, the Montreal Hibou, or Les Hibou de Montréal. They started in 1976.
Okay.
And there was a number of other adult programs of adults who were playing blind hockey. There's a team out in Newfoundland. There's teams out in Alberta, Calgary, Edmonton, a team out in Vancouver. And what's so interesting is all these teams played with different rules, different pucks, like different adaptive noise-making pucks. And none of these teams actually even communicated with one another. It was like this underground blind hockey society that no one even knew about, and they didn't even know about each other. And so when I entered and started learning about the Ice Owls and blind hockey, I started really educating myself on the history and the current state at the time of what it was all about. And what I recognized pretty quick was two things. One was there wasn't a community, which where I'm from in Weston, the hockey community was so important, the togetherness, being with each other. And number two, what really hit me was finding out that there were no kids programs for kids who were blind or partially sighted to get a shot at hockey, which also hit me because I had that shot growing up, right?
Yep.
And so for a while, I remember just it always stuck with me saying, this isn't right. Like we need to do something about this. And I think I was always taught, you know, if you want to make a difference in life, you need to take action. And that really was two moments that I learned, that I was like, you know what? I sometimes think maybe this whole blindness thing that happened to me maybe happened for a reason. Mm-hmm. And, I really felt like I had purpose then.
I mean, let's talk about something that maybe was a little bit crazy that you did, because in 2009, I don't know if anybody else would have attempted this, but it seems like this was your calling, as you were saying. You skated, that's inline skates and or rollerblades, folks, in terms of skated, but skated from Toronto to Vancouver to raise funds to help blind hockey programs, and then you went the other way in 2011 when you skated from Toronto to Halifax. All total, you went about 7,000 kilometers across Canada on inline skates, which is, I mean, phenomenal, if not awesome. Mm-hmm. Like, that's crazy. But I mean, let's ask the obvious. How were the roads? And and secondly, how much did you actually raise in those two trips?
The roads were tough. I always say to people, ask, was it physically tough or mentally tough? And I say it was probably mentally tougher than it was physically. Mm-hmm. I also wasn't, like, one thing people don't realize, like, I also wasn't in shape. I was, you know, fresh out of university. I wasn't in shape. I was so focused on organizing the event that I don't even remember training. I tried my best to, but again, it's so different when you're playing hockey every day versus having to then go to the gym and then the battles of going to the gym with sight loss. And
yeah.
So, I mean, I think it was half crazy. Looking back, I just, you know what, I had this idea about wanting to start, Courage Canada, inspired through her Carnegie's Creed Courage, as we spoke about. The word will be a continuous theme. I was like, you know, one day I was sitting by my bed and saw a pair of rollerblades there, an old pair of skates I used to skate to middle school with, the ones with a couple buckles. And this is after I lost my sight, when I was, you know, after my time at Western, and I remember putting them on, skating up and down the street, and it just felt good again to be actually moving and skating. And then I had this crazy idea that I was going to rollerblade across Canada from Toronto to Vancouver, which was at the time was home of the 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Games. And I was kind of like, I just looked it up and was like, you know, I have no excuse. If I could strap on these rollerblades and skate from Toronto to Vancouver, then there's no reason why anyone else who's blind or partially sighted can't give hockey a try as well. And that first campaign from Toronto to Vancouver took 111 days, went through about three pairs of skates, about 100 wheels.
Oh, jeez.
And we raised about $100,000 that first that first trip. This is a pretty cool story to share, but we had no money to start it because I was starting with, I think I had like 10 grand inheritance from my grandmother who had passed just before in 2007. So I started with some money that was left behind after passing. But the The one person that ended up really stepping up at the time, which most people are shocked when I say this, but who caught wind of my campaign, was the late Ottawa Senators owner, Eugene Melnyk.
Oh, wow.
And he ended up donating about $20,000 towards like a motorhome, and he was just really inspired, I guess, and found out about it, and all of a sudden I was doing some calls with Eugene Melnyk, and Johnny Bauer was also a big supporter, rest his soul. And the other one that hits me now, due to the tragedy the other day, is the late Ron Ellis, who just passed, and Ron was such a huge supporter, and so I have this photo I always look at of me, Eugene Melnyk, Johnny Bauer, and Ron Ellis. I still have days before the takeoff in 2009 on the rollerblade, and I look at this photo often because it really means a lot. And and then the rest, I would say that the roads were tough. The roads are tough. I think most people always say to me, "Oh, the prairies must have been easy, flat, straight, smooth." And I would say the prairies were some of the most mentally exhausting days of my life.
Yeah.
And I always say that because everything kind of looks the same.
I was going to say, you don't know if you're making progress.
Yeah, you don't feel like you're progressing. And we're like in northern Ontario going around Lake Superior, you're kind of like, "Oh, this is cool. I'm seeing different things off the peripheral of my eyes with the team." But as soon as we hit like really East Braintree coming in, it was like everything kind of looked the same for a while.
It's funny. It's funny you say that because I have a colleague from Toronto who's here last summer, and he said he's like, "Everything looks the same out here." Like we're driving from like Winnipeg to Brandon, and he's like, the whole scenery doesn't change. It's the same thing.
What do you mean? It's wheat field, cornfield, canola field, and just keeps going.
So I understand your experience then, because he was the exact same way. He's like, this doesn't change.
And then it was like one of the biggest things that we kept. And like, I just want to say, like, the people were amazing. Like the families that would take us in.
Yeah.
My buddies Cam, PJ, and Jay at the time were with me, and the families would take us in, give us a, you know, a bed or a warm meal, or give us a shower. We would park our motorhome in campgrounds, and like people would just be pulling over, like making donations. Like it was truly something. But what I kept hearing a lot about was everyone kept just saying, "Be careful for Rogers Pass." Like I heard that for like provinces. It was like, "Be careful for Rogers Pass," which is a major mountain pass.
Yeah.
When you get into British Columbia, and I was a kid from Toronto. I didn't know what Rogers Pass was, who Roger was. Like, I didn't know what was going on, right? So I started hearing it more and more that it was almost a silent demon that was hitting me throughout the prairies, where people were like, "Rogers Pass, how are you going to get through Rogers Pass?" And so it kind of gave me a bit of anxiety on the skate. I think that's one thing I don't really talk about often, but when I was doing the skate, it was this demon of me, of this mountain climb that I was thinking about in the Rockies the whole time. And I was like, is this going to end my trip? Is this going to fail me? Is this going to fail the cause? And then, you know what? We found ourselves confronting Rogers Pass and kicking horse and everything. And it was just, but I think what really got me on that trip was we were on a mission to meet kids who were blind or partially sighted who wanted to play hockey. And that Thanksgiving weekend, it was in October at the time, we ended up meeting kind of the first family who had a child, 10 years old, Zach, who was partially sighted and loved hockey and really wanted to play. And I kind of said to the team from the very beginning, "Look, if we can change one kid's life through this rollerblade, we've done our job." And after that had happened, I wasn't scared of Rogers Pass or any pass, because I was fired up with motivation that it just really brought full circle the true reason and purpose of why we were doing what we were doing. But my friends at the time, like, to think that these guys like took out, like, none of them were getting paid. They were all volunteers. We were all volunteers. But none of these guys, they took away like 3 months, 4 months of their life to skate with me, to work the motorhome, to make calls to campgrounds, to radio stations. Like, it really like made me think about, especially, you know, in 1980 when Terry Fox did.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. His Marathon of Hope, thinking of like the role Daryl Fox and Doug Allward played in his life, you know, his support team that was with him. And there was a lot of times I remember when I was having tough nights trying to get out of bed, like just going on YouTube and watching like Terry Fox videos. Just like, because like, it's cool that I rollerbladed across Canada and did these trips, but like no one will ever, and I mean ever, replace Terry Fox's legacy of what he did.
Right.
What he did is like, I like, it's like, there's nothing like it. I mean, and so when I was having a tough day, like I thought of Terry and was just like, this guy did it on one leg, not to mention his prosthetic was like an older type of prosthetic. It wasn't like the new form technology. And this guy did this with blood coming out of his stump, like just like, just like didn't it. And he did it for the cause. And sometimes when things would get to me and my head would get too big, or I would feel like, you know, I was losing track of why we did this to begin with, you know, Terry's story really put me in place and really made me check myself to say, remember, this is about the cause. And that was a big part of a lot of late nights trying to find Wi-Fi in campgrounds was me sitting in the back room just learning about this guy who was the same age as me, 22, when he did his Marathon of Hope, when I did my Quest to the West in 2009. The one guy I always say I would love to meet.
So, I mean, just before we go on here, I mean, we're talking with Mark DeMontis, who is the founder of Courage Canada, and obviously we want to, you know, make sure that everybody knows who we're talking to here in terms of getting your information on here. I want to get into the game, though, because, I mean, again, we're not going to take, you know, you mentioned Courage Canada, raising money, doing all the good stuff to try and get, you know, hockey programs started. That's what Courage Canada was for. It was a charity to start hockey programs for blind and partially sighted individuals in 2010. But let's get into the hockey thing, because, again, we have no idea. I mean, we have an idea. Like, don't get me wrong, but we have no idea sort of how the game is played, and we've never seen it played because there isn't a blind hockey association that I know of in Winnipeg anyway. So, I mean, again, confirm or deny in terms of some of this stuff, but let's start with the players. What's the criteria needed in order to qualify as a player for blind hockey?
So, there's blind hockey at the international level. There's a classification for if you'd be, you know, legally blind, which is 10% sight or less deaf. So, most people in Canada who are deemed legally blind would qualify for, you know, for the CNIB, for the Canadian National League for the Blind.
Yeah.
Would hold a CNIB card, so that for the most part would tell you if you are legally blind, right? And so vision ranges, there's hundreds of thousands of different eye conditions out there. So people range from having some partial sight, whether they have just peripheral sight or they have just tunnel vision, or they have different types of eye conditions, all the way down to people who are totally blind. And it's kind of a game for anyone and everyone, even despite their level of sight. And I think that the main difference is, you know, if you were to walk into a hockey arena, you know, you probably wouldn't notice a difference right away walking in. But what would catch your attention would be a larger noise-making puck that you would think would be different. And right away, you probably wouldn't totally figure out that the players are blind yet. But again, it's still the same great game. It's fast. Quite fearless. A lot of players like myself played hockey competitively, and like myself were faced with an eye condition at some point in their hockey career, or maybe played that way legally blind for most of their life. And it's a few other modifications. One is the puck is 3 feet in height, not 4.
Okay.
It's there is one other rule that's a great rule. It's called a one pass rule, where when you gain the offensive zone, you need to make a crisp pass to a teammate, which would be followed by the refs making a high whistle pitch, a different type of whistle than a traditional whistle in hockey. They'd make a pitch that would the high pitch that would indicate that now you're eligible to score, because all goalies on the ice are fully blind.
Oh, wow.
They are completely blind. So they're doing everything based on tracking, hearing. And so that whistle now tells the goalies and players in the game that, the team is eligible to score and that a shot could happen at any point. And, but again, it's like, other than some of these modifications, it's still a great game that everyone loves. It's fast. Again, it's family friendly. There's no fighting. There might be a couple blindside hits accidentally. but like it's a respect sport. I have to say, like, it's actually quite refreshing when someone comes to watch a blind hockey game, because you don't see what you typically see in hockey. You don't see the rubbish or the in your face play or the chirping, or it's really a big community, and the camaraderie is amazing. It's the fact that people can still play the game they love even despite their disability.
Yeah.
I think people are just happy to be playing, lacing up a pair of skates, and I'm just so proud to be part of the community. Some of my best friends are in this community, and the feeling you get when you get an email or the organization finds out that there's a new blind hockey player that just found out about it. Those feelings are like when you win the lottery, because you know it's going to change their life. They may not know it yet, but we know it. So every time we find out about a new player, it's one of those feelings that you're like, we can't wait for them to meet the community and get a chance.
That's so awesome.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that caught my attention is Team Canada often wears yellow instead of the typical red and white. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, it's a contrast. It's a good point. I forgot about that one. It's a contrast reason. So traditionally in hockey, one team wears white, the other team wears a dark color. But in blind hockey, because the ice is white and the boards are often white, it would be really difficult for teams to kind of navigate amongst each other if one team wears white. So one team always wears a high contrast yellow or gold, which makes it easier for the players to know who's on their team versus thinking they're seeing a player even though it's just ice, or they're seeing the boards even though you're a player even though it's just the boards. So the high contrast yellow is it makes the game a lot more accessible. And that's just not like in hockey, it's just even in society often, when we look at tactile surfaces, we often see their high contrast yellow. It's often a common agreed color that people who are blind or partially sighted find, make things more accessible for them, and no different than in hockey.
I mean, I'm going to sort of jump the gun a little bit here, now that we know how the game is played, because 2016, Courage Canada became the Canadian Blind Hockey Association, so congratulations on that sort of transition, because it became the first organization of its kind in the world, from what we understand. Mm-hmm. Pretty significant achievement, I would say, in terms of what they, that sort of move into becoming a blind hockey association. But one of the big things you guys do every year is you guys hold the annual Canadian National Blind Hockey Tournament. Again, takes an army to put of volunteers and staff to put that on. So kudos to the staff and volunteers that do that. They're the true heroes. But I got to ask you, I mean, how much pride does it give you, Mark, when you hear, the 2024 tournament was the 10th anniversary, number one, of the tournament, and that teams from six different countries were participating this year?
Yeah, and you said it. It's really to the staff and the board, and the incredible staff from the executive director Matt Morrow down to program manager Luca DeMontis, my own brother, to marketing communications with Melanie Carey and the board. I want to give them all a shout out, from Greg Mannion to Hugh Shaw, Frank Nazier, Laura Bark, Bruno Hache, and then all the endless volunteers across the country that come together for this tournament. For me, it's a special moment, and it's so hard to even describe, because for 10 years now, we've seen this, what started with only 45 players back in 2013. We barely had enough funding, enough players, we barely had rules, and to see it now turn into this monstrosity of an event, it's a proud feeling, but it's also very emotional.
Yeah.
Now we get, a few thousand students from Toronto who come watch it. They're all singing the anthem, and I think for me what's inspiring is the fact that there's kids who are being educated, who are learning that people who are blind or partially sighted not just can play hockey, but they can contribute and participate in life.
That's awesome.
And that education factor is just as important as people playing the game, but educating people who don't have disabilities, that people with disabilities can still do awesome things like play hockey. Mm-hmm. So I think that education, that awareness is really emotional for me. And I think it's also very emotional for my family, my brother, my parents, who saw it one time as me being a kid who was going through some tough times, and then now we're at this point. But as much as I sometimes get the recognition or get credit for it, like this community wouldn't be where it is if it wasn't for the community. like the community, and I don't just mean the community at large, but I mean the families, the parents, the kids who are from their respective communities and towns and regions across the country who put on now their local programs and their events, and they raise their own money through fundraisers. Like that is, that's why it is where it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would say these kids and their families inspire me more than I ever even try to inspire them. They are the true reason we are where we are in the community. And now you're seeing the United States picking up the game. They're growing fast with youth programs across the United States to adult programs. They have ICE to national team now. And now there's other countries around the world who are catching wind. I think the national tournament trial has been a large part of that.
And you know, sledge hockey is a pretty important place in the history of this show. We've had quite a few folks from that community on the show before, but it has a home at the Paralympic Games. But blind hockey has been kept out of the games thus far. How close do you think we are to having blind hockey at the Paralympics?
And I think it's an honest question as well, only because mm-hmm. it's such a different game from sledge hockey as well, that it is a different event. It should be considered like a different event, right? Like, I'm shocked that you guys, and I know that it comes with, again, participation and having more countries available, but I'm shocked that it's not even considered as being part of the Paralympics yet. Mm-hmm. Are we close to seeing that, Mark?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where in order to get to the Paralympics, you need to get to a World Championships. In order to get to a World Championships, you need to get to a Four Nations. And the one thing that blind hockey has going for it is that blindness is considered part of the Paralympics.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Winter Paralympics is in need of more blind sports, but most importantly, especially blind team sports. And so there's a great opportunity for blind hockey to get there, but in order to get there, it needs more countries. It needs more support. And in fact, recently, a couple weeks ago, Hockey Canada, they rolled up their sleeves and said, hey, we want to help you out. And part of the World Para Hockey Championships in Calgary, we were able to put on two demonstration games for the eight countries that were participating.
Right on. Mm-hmm.
Which was the first time that we've actually been able to play in front of other countries, especially those who make decisions at a level. And so there's teams like Korea, China, Japan, Italy, Czechia. There's all these teams that were finding out about blind hockey for the first time. And now all of a sudden it's about the global effort now. There's great work being done in Canada, great work being done in the United States, but now it's about continuing to work with our friends in Finland and Sweden and other countries. A lot happening in the UK as well. And that global movement to lead to more countries, that's going to be the key. But I tell you, if you've never seen blind hockey and you get a chance to watch Canada play USA, go on to Canadian Blind Hockey's YouTube channel. You can get at canadianblindhockey.com.
Yeah.
And if you want to watch blind hockey, it's at a competitive form. Canada USA International Blind Ice Hockey is no different than Canada USA at the para level or sled level or at any other discipline. It's fast, it's serious, and everything's on the line.
Amazing.
We'd be remiss, and I'm not trying to take anything away from him because obviously he's a big part of the Canadian Blind Hockey family in terms of the community and certainly your family. But your brother, Luca DeMontis, obviously is a big part. He plays. He's national team general manager. How great has it been having Luca sort of alongside you for this journey?
It's been incredible. I think being able to share with family this whole experience and these memories is, my brother being sighted has been there for me since day one, being able to see me, ever since I lost my sight, but see how blind hockey and discovering that sport and its existence, seeing the impact it's had on me. And now seeing him, working for the organization, being general manager of the national team, and it's a really cool feeling. It's not easy, your brother being the GM, I'll tell you that. Look, he is not just a GM. He is a mentor to the players. He's the type of guy, he tells the team, his phone's always on. If you ever need anything, you call him. He's very much a believer in the players. And we've reached a point where it's a serious sport. Having him, just traveling with him, being to these events and, being able to represent our country together, him and the management side, me as a player, it's a really cool feeling. I don't think it's one that, I think it's one that we take for granted. And I think I couldn't imagine for our parents how emotional it is for them seeing us do this together. And even as mentioned, my you know, my best friend Paul Cairns being the head coach of the team.
Yeah.
I've known Paul since, you know, first day as a junior kindergarten, and it's like all of a sudden it's, you know, it's like you got your best friend as the coach, your brother as the GM, and you better play well, right? No, Luke's been phenomenal, but to see him with the kids is something like the amount of work he does to develop like youth blind hockey and working with boys and girls who are blind and partially sighted in communities across the country. He's even been out to Winnipeg. He's been everywhere putting on youth programs in every town, region. And to see his relationship with the kids, it's pretty cool. Because it was what I always wanted to happen. So to see my brother actually carrying the torch and making it happen, there's no better feeling.
Yeah, and you mentioned Luca being here at an event in Winnipeg. There are calls from players who believe Winnipeg and Manitoba should have a blind hockey team. What advice do you have for those players and their families and their supporters when it comes to getting a team off the ground?
Well, I think that Winnipeg should, and I think that like anything, it takes a community, right? It takes people to come together, and it takes a lot of work making phone calls to local associations who impact the lives of people who are blind or partially sighted. Really working with organizations, working with communities, calling minor hockey associations. It will happen. There will be a blind hockey program in Winnipeg. I'm very confident of that. And there's players who are blind, I don't doubt, in Manitoba. There was a talk in Saskatchewan, and we felt the same thing. And now Saskatchewan's got programs in Regina, Saskatoon. There's players who are coming from Saskatchewan to the national tournament. I just took the ice with a few of them in Calgary, for example. And so there's players in Manitoba. We know there are. And I know there's a few who come to the national tournament. Shout out to Scarlett. She's always there, coming out from Manitoba, and she's been a big advocate in the region. And
right on.
It's an exciting time for Winnipeg for blind hockey. And you know, I think that not only am I confident it's going to happen, I think it's just a matter of when. But Winnipeg's a hockey town, and it deserves a program, not just blind hockey program, but any form of adaptive hockey program. There shouldn't be anyone left behind out there.
A couple of fun questions now for you, Mark. We do usually do a few of these softball questions at the end here. Are you ready for a couple of funny sort of questions? And you can, again, doesn't take a lot of answers in terms of a lot of words here, but you can give us sort of some ideas here. You wear number 9 for the national team. Is there any significance to that number for you?
Grade 9. I was the only grade 9 in school senior hockey team.
Okay.
So they threw me number 9 because of it, and haven't looked back since. It's been kind of a family number now. My cousin Robbie wore 9 at Yale, and I'm sure I'll be wearing 9 for a long time. Yeah.
You guys were at the NHL All-Star Game this year, Canadian Blind Hockey Association, at a booth at the Fanfare. Did any NHL players stop by to see if this to try their hand at blind hockey?
It's a good chance. I know Mitch Marner has been a big supporter of blind hockey, and I know he was there, and he's always getting blind hockey involved as part of his annual event, the Marner Assist Fund. We've been fortunate for a lot of NHLers to find out about blind hockey through the programs Canadian Blind Hockey's done at the youth level, partnering with a number of different NHL teams, and they've done this in a few regions now. And so I'm sure there was a lot of folks coming out. There were I couldn't believe, like, the line to get to try blind hockey was longer than the free samples of Molson Canadiens.
Oh, wow. there you go.
people were very curious to find out, wearing simulation goggles, like, what it was like to try it. And I was really proud of that because, again, that education factor, right?
Yeah, for sure. No, that's awesome. We had a listener send us a question from social media earlier this week, a lady by the name of Ashley, who sent in, and she wanted to know, Mark, we're told that, you know, other senses get heightened when you lose a sense. Obviously, there are a lot of sounds in hockey, but do you find the smells of hockey, the ammonia when you walk into the rink, the concessions, the stinky hockey equipment, that kind of stuff, are those more noticeable now for you?
You know what? It's a good question, Ashley, and I think what it does is it brings me back to, I would say, the smell of hockey, like what I fell in love with in the first place when I first started playing as like a 4-year-old. It's that smell when you enter an arena at like 6 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, the smell of hockey gear. It makes people say it smells stinky, but for me it smells Canadian. I guess, you rely on your senses more, whether it's hearing or smell. For those that, you know, have those senses still, it doesn't mean that just because you're blind that you don't have those senses. Like, there's a lot of people who are blind hockey players that, still have a hearing impairment or may have other you know, difficulties with their senses too. I'd say I'm always picking up on the smell, and yeah, the room stinks, bottom line. Right? there's a lot of, but that's hockey. And there's a lot of, I'd say nothing beats it.
All right. Always ask this question to our guests, so we're going to get your answer for it as well. Because again, the answers are super interesting in terms of what we hear. But if you now, 37-year-old Mark DeBontis, could go back in time and give 17-year-old Mark DeMontis a little bit of advice, knowing everything you know now, what advice would you give yourself?
The advice I'd probably give myself is, like, cut yourself some slack. Like, don't be so hard on yourself. And things happen in life, and not, like, don't. It didn't happen to you purposely. It didn't pick on you specifically. Give it a shot. Like, and again, don't take for granted any day. Joseph Del Grande, one of my teammates, always says, it's a good day when you're 6 feet above ground. And he always says that to him with a smile on his face. And then, you know what I always say to him, like, you know, that's, like, just don't take anything for granted. But I'd say, be kind to yourself. That's the biggest thing I'd probably say to my 17-year-old self. Be kind to yourself.
That is
good. You didn't choose this. You didn't choose blindness. Blindness chose you, right?
That is good advice, though, because, I mean, again, a lot of people put a lot of pressure on themselves that age, and certainly, you know, you sounded like you did as well in terms of what you overcame. So good advice for sure. We're just about out of time here. We've got about 30 seconds to go. Anything else you want to add in here, Mark? Anything that you want to throw in terms of, like, reaching on social media or anything like that? By all means, the soapbox is yours if you want it.
You know, I just really want to thank you for having me on, and really thank my brother for the nomination for the 2024 Willie O'Ree Award. People have been voting and supporting, and you know, I'm sharing this honor with two other finalists, and that are doing amazing work as well. And you can vote at nhl.com/O'Ree Award. That's nhl.com/OREE Award. And again, if successful, Canadian Blind Hockey will be a recipient of $25,000 to go towards the cause and to start more programs and advance the game. And again, if you're out there and you're listening and you're someone who is visually impaired and you want to give hockey a shot, my advice I would say is be kind to yourself first, but second, like, I really hope you do it, because you're going to meet a life-changing community that's going to have an impact on you on and off the ice.
Mark DeMontis, we cannot thank you enough for doing this. This has been a fantastic chat. I wish we had another hour, because we probably could go over about 100 other things. We'll definitely have you on again, though. Door will always be open if you want to come back.
Don't say that. I'll be back tomorrow, guys. I appreciate it, though, and thank you for taking the time, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, you know what? We'll follow up the summer. I know there's a few development camps. We'll follow up the summer, and we'll certainly get some more information from you as well, and we'll make sure we stay in touch. That's for sure.
Thanks, guys, and I'd like to say have fun watching the Canucks Oilers game tonight. We'll see what happens here, and enjoy.
We're pulling forward with them as well. That's awesome. Can't thank you enough for this, Mark. Definitely have a great night, and we will absolutely talk to you in the near future for sure.
Thanks, Mark.
You take care. Thanks, guys.
So there's Mark DeMontis as we get out of here for another night. Jason, anything you want to say before we go?
Oh, that was just a fantastic interview.
Mark was outstanding. Yeah. I'm glad that we had him on. I'm glad that we got a chance to talk to him. He definitely knows his stuff when it comes to this game. And we're going to get out of here with another song that Mark picked. You might recognize this song. Some people are going to go, you're mean for playing this song. I didn't pick it. Mark picked this song. Yep. Here is 5440 with their classic tune, I Go Blind. You've been listening to The Hockey Show on Thursday night. Stay tuned for Skippy here with Free Range Radio on 101.5 UMFM. Now,
So you understand the situation here.
All right, it's your lucky day.
You're listening to CJUM FM 101.5 megahertz on the FM dial from Winnipeg.
And that is how you do that.
Amazing.
That was kind of impressive.